This is continuing with Grote Reber on 25th October 75.
See, during this period, the Maltese were finding their way onto junk heap.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a very abundant source of this kind of stuff.
Right.
But if you went out to do it today, you couldn't find them because they've all long since been gone to melt.
Sure, sure. And this was the declination drive, essentially?
That's right.
And was it a hand crank sort of arrangement that you
had?
It's
the crank.
Right.
Doesn't show very well, but there's the handle of the crank, uh-huh. There's the shaft of the crank, and then it bends over, slips on there, and it's a spline, and that allows the crank to be taken off so the kids can't crank it.
Right.
Because we were only in a couple blocks of the school.
Right.
And the kids used to come in the afternoon and play on this thing, you know, like they play on.
Right. Just a big
playground.
Big jungle gym. Yeah.
Climb all over it.
I love that point in one of these articles where you got a very southern measurement because the dish got stuck there in a snowstorm, and so you just took advantage of it.
That's right.
How did you get the dish unstuck?
I got a fellow at the local garage, the blacksmith that did some of this blacksmithing for me. See, well, out in that small town, they had a fellow who was sort of a general mechanic, and he represented an automobile dealership, and he did blacksmithing and this, that, and the other thing. He had a steam engine that drove a lathe and things. And he was the fellow that helped me, or in some cases did, a lot of the mechanical work on all this metal. See, we bought the metal in Chicago from steel sales, mm-hmm. and brought out by truck, and then sawed up and drilled and bent at his place, this blacksmith. So I got the blacksmith to come there as soon as the weather got good enough in a few days, and we jacked this thing back up and put it back on the track.
Nice. I thought that was real ingenuity to take advantage of that. Oh, let's see. Page 376. You said that, unfortunately, the present method of scanning along declination lines makes it quite difficult to obtain good data beyond deck equal plus 45 degrees. Why was that?
Well, it's because just the Earth is going slowly, that's all.
But in fact, you get more sensitivity. Because you get more integration time per beam.
Oh, I see what you mean.
I don't see why that makes it more difficult.
Well, maybe that's a bad statement. Actually, I can't say that it's true because the data seems to be just as good up there, doesn't it?
Right, right.
Yeah. According to the present scan, okay.
I thought it might be something to do with when the dish got tilted past the zenith that you ran into problems of some sort.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just that since the Earth is turning so slow, the records get spread all out.
Ah, right. Then the drift.
See?
So, and actually, the integration time was too long, really.
Well, if this is your baseline like that.
Sure, if it wanders.
It spreads everything way out, and so it becomes more difficult to get these things off.
Right.
Get the ordnance off.
Right.
I think that's it.
That's probably it indeed. And then this is the article where you say that you'd like to move out into the desert somewhere far away from man-made disturbances.
This is 1942, is it?
Right. I guess the question is, so why didn't you move out there?
Well, see, the war came on 41, probably about time or a little after the time this was written. When did this appear?
This was
August 1942.
Received in August 1941, though.
But see, the war hadn't begun yet, at least for us.
Right.
Damn, it took them a year to get that thing into print, didn't it?
That was a revised manuscript in May 1942, so there was some big delay there.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a referee sort of thing?
Probably just the war.
You know, but why did you have to revise it, though?
Oh, I don't know. I don't even know what was revised. We'd have to look.
Yeah.
I think I probably got all the revisions. You know, I saved most of that stuff.
Yeah, I'd really like to go through that sometime with you.
Well, in any case, see, by this time, it was evident that some really good results could be had, and I was getting them slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also evident that the location I had there was far from optimum with all these man-made difficulties.
Right.
And it would be a good idea if we had an arrangement where we could look in some direction other than along the meridian, which wasn't possible there because of the hemmed-in circumstances. And so it seemed as though it would be a good idea to get out of there and get to some place farther away. And to do that, if we're going to do that, then it seemed to be best if I fixed the equipment up with adjustment in azimuth as well as an altitude. And so, see, by this time I've been working for some time, and I had more resources at my command. And so I bought some more iron and made up another design, and bought the iron, and this blacksmith made up the turntable.
I see.
This must have been 1941. And the turntable was completely assembled in this blacksmith's shop, all put together. And then it was all taken apart and stored in the garage at home where this my apparatus was. Because about that time, or a little prior to that, Yerkes Observatory had acquired McDonald Observatory in Texas. And I've been going back and forth to Yerkes from time to time on various subjects, and they had a lot of land down there, and it seemed as though maybe it would be a good idea if we could get the resources and the time to move the whole shebang down there to McDonald.
Right.
Because it'd be a lower latitude, the climate would be now better, but we wouldn't have near so much electrical disturbances.
Right.
And if it was near the observatory itself, if we had some electrical disturbances, they would probably be coming to the observatory and we'd be able to control them. Most electrical disturbances can be quieted down if you can find out where they are and get control over them.
Sure.
Impossible where I was there. So I had made some this sort of cursory arrangements with Struby. But the war came on and all this stuff stood in storage. We couldn't do anything until after the war was over.
So you might really have set up an observatory down there if it hadn't been for
the war. Well, that was the idea. If the war hadn't come on and we got involved in that mess, I think I could have moved everything down there. And that would have been the logical thing to do. In fact, that would have been a lot better thing to do than me going to the Bureau of Standards, which turned out to be pretty much of a mistake. But there wasn't anything offering at that time. There was no National Science Foundation. There was no other resources available. And we might have got some money out of, who knows, Carnegie or Rockefeller, I don't know, see. But that's all water over the dam. It was one of those if things.
Now, being able to move an azimuth, were you thinking of actually tracking the source?
Well, no, I think what I was... See, now this was 1941. This was before I discovered the radio waves from the sun, much less the transients. So there wasn't any incentive that way. But what I was thinking of was trying to speed up this business of taking the data.
I see.
Because you wouldn't need near as much receiver stability. In other words, revert back to something like Jansky had, where we made sweeps around the horizon.
I see.
And then maybe make another sweep at a higher elevation angle. In other words, instead of taking a year to get a survey, we could do the whole thing in a month or
so
less.
So the Earth was really giving you too slow a data rate.
That's
and you
right.
wanted to speed it up.
Really was. You could only get one sweep out in a night. And if you were had bad luck and had interference or equipment difficulty, that was shot and you had to wait till next night or a couple nights later. It was a very slow and laborious thing. And especially when you got north plus 45. Now look at it. The polar region was beyond Cassiopeia, was practically non-existent. There just didn't turn up there. Sky didn't turn, see? But if you had an azimuth sweep, that could all be taken care of.
Right.
So there was a lot of good possibilities. And, well, I've had a lot of good results. You can't expect to hit the nail every time.
Can't win them all. You mentioned interference, and the automobile ignitions were the worst thing by far, it appears from your traces. Were there other things that bothered you in the neighborhood that you would have liked to have eliminated?
Well, the main thing was automobiles, but there were some other things. There was some people there that had sparking oil burners. These things would come on at night occasionally, especially in the wintertime. They usually didn't last long because if they were so bad as that, they maybe, well, most likely would fail within a few nights completely, and then they'd have to get them fixed. In the daytime, there were other kinds of disturbances in the form of women running cake mixers and this kind of thing. And a lot of my records show my electric razor, which I still use.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's an old chick. I've had it for umpteen years.
Amazing.
So, aside from the automobiles, there wasn't a great many, a few.
You didn't make any efforts to
hunt them down
and, you know, actually put a shield over your neighbor's furnace or anything like that?
It didn't seem warranted. Yeah. I didn't have the time or the effort or the incentive. You just put up with them.
Yeah. Okay, now moving to your 19...
We did get a few interferences from the mobile transmitters on automobiles. At that time, most of that mobile stuff was around 30 megacycles or so.
You mean taxi cabs, this sort of thing?
Yeah, and the police had some, and I think it was mainly the police and the taxi cabs. But I didn't get it unless they were pretty close. It was within a couple blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was harmonic radiation.
Yeah.
But that wasn't often enough to be objectionable.
Okay, moving on to your 44 paper, a couple of questions. You had an idea of the Milky Way having structure now, and you talk about the various peaks along the Milky Way. And you make the statement that the intensity is roughly indicative of the amount of material between us and the edge of the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
On this basis, the various maxima point to the directions of projections from the Milky Way. These projections may be similar to the arms often photographed in other spiral nebulae.
That was just a guess and a bad one.
Well, no, but I'm wondering, was your picture that we were somewhat outside of our own Milky Way?
Probably.
And that there was sort of a disk that we were just outside, and that this disk had projections on it?
Probably.
That's the sort of, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a bad guess at all.
That was, you see, on the basis that this stuff was due to free transitions.
Sure.
And it now turns out that these bright spots had nothing to do with free transitions.
Right, but nevertheless, Mills, of course, 10 years later, showed that the continuum radiation peaks along spiral arms, I mean the synchrotron radiation as we now call it, so that you can see spiral structure in the continuum also, so it's not way off base at all. The only thing that one would say now is that we think of ourselves as being inside the Milky Way, and that these arms are all around us rather than that we're sort of just outside of it.
Well, you know, here, if you look out there in the direction of Perseus, the Milky Way sort of disappears into the background. It's damn difficult to find out just where the Milky Way is in Perseus.
Yeah, it's certainly much weaker there than it is towards the center, of course.
So we must be pretty near the edge.
Well, let's put it this way, we're much more near the edge optically than we are on the radio.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's much more hydrogen outside of us relative to the center than there is light.
Yeah.
And likewise with the radio continuum, I think. Okay. I like these plots that you show here. This one's taken on Christmas, 43. This one is New Year's Day, 44. Whenever you weren't working.
Yeah.
All of these others are taken on Sundays.
I don't doubt it.
Now, here... Okay, now you're trying to explain the discrepancy that the sun is a strong source, but that this source must be greatly discounted when explaining the origin of cosmic static. If it were the source, meaning that if the cosmic static came from all the stars, I guess, and the Milky Way are made of average stars like the sun, a very large area in Sagittarius would have a visible intensity equal to that of the sun. That would be if you had no dark matter, of course. Since this is not the case, some other cause must be found to make up the difference of 20 or 30 magnitudes. Now I'm wondering, is what you mean there that the ratio of optical to radio in the Milky Way is 20 to 30 magnitudes different than the ratio of optical to radio for the sun. Is that what you mean?
In the sun. Mm-hmm. That's the general idea.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that's about right. So I'm making a footnote here. Reber is saying here that the ratio of radio to optical intensity from the Milky Way is about 10 to the 10th times that same ratio for the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I just wasn't sure I had that right. Okay, that's about it for this paper. Specific questions. Now the 1948 paper. I don't think I had any specific things there. Okay. Now this review that you wrote with Jesse Greenstein, mm-hmm. for Monthly Notices, mm-hmm. this is really the first thorough review of radio astronomy,
mm-hmm.
and I was just wondering how this came about. And
when was this?
In 47 it was
February
published.
February 47. Mm-hmm. I was still in Illinois.
It's probably written in 46.
Well, I don't know how it came about, but it's, I had had contacts off and on over the years with the people of Yerkes, and whether he or I, or both of us, or somebody else pushed us onto it, I don't know. But it seemed as though now that the war was over and we had some time to collect our wits and had access to a considerable lot of information, it would be worthwhile to put it together.
Well, it's interesting because this is the first time that an optical and a radio astronomer have gotten together.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's the first time that radio astronomy is sort of becoming accepted, at least by some optical astronomers. Certainly there was still a lot of prejudice.
I didn't realize it. Is this the first time an optical and radio astronomer have written a joint paper?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
And it's also the first time... No, that's not true. Because there were your papers in Astrophysical Journal. But this was an observatory, which is, of course, an astronomy journal.
Now, you're going to ask me why we sent it to this bunch, why we didn't patronize home industry.
Oh, I don't know. No, I'm not going to ask you.
That I don't know either.
I wasn't going to ask you that. But you do in here, you talk a little bit about the errors in your measurements, mm-hmm. About how reliable they are.
Mm-hmm.
It's improbable that errors as large as a factor of 10 exist, but errors of the factor of 2 are not excluded.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, why didn't you put some similar sort of discussions in the original papers?
Probably because at that time I hadn't given it any great thought. But by this time, Greenstein was probably asking me questions about how reliable were these things.
Right, trying to pin you down.
And,
I've been trying to do that.
And I was trying to give him some, you know, rough cut idea of what things were. Here's this one.
Yes, right. 16 September, and that's exactly what is in Jansky's paper, right?
Yeah, and I thought it was pretty good. That it shows it definitely goes along here.
I
go ahead and look at them.
Okay, now if we just take a look at your engineering articles, here's one in 47 on antenna focal devices for parabolic mirrors. How does this relate now to what was used in the radio astronomy experience?
Well, I needed a broadband antenna. And so this was an attempt to find out the impedance parameters of various broadband designs.
And now, was this applicable to all of the different frequencies you used?
Well, this was particularly a development on the feet for 480 megacycles.
For the last one, yeah. That's what I'm saying, okay. And now, this 44 article on reflector efficiency, this was the 160 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
Thing primarily, right? And how to illuminate the dish and so forth.
I'd forgotten about this. This was an elaborate thing, wasn't it?
Oh, you had all the equations that are columns long in this paper. And then here's the actual illumination curve,
mm-hmm.
That you had.
Mm-hmm.
And then electromagnetic horns in 1939.
Yeah, this is some of that microwave stuff.
Now, did you ever use such horns on your antenna?
Yes. At 3,300 megacycles, I used a horn similar to this one.
Right. And what about at 910 also?
No, at 910 I just used a cylinder. And here, this thing... In other words, if you want to get the maximum directivity out of a horn of a given aperture mm-hmm. and length, you don't do this and you don't do that, but you build it like that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you found this out experimentally, basically. So this was only, this was not used for the 480 megahertz either, just the 3300.
That's all.
Yeah. Okay.
It was sort of an engineering exercise, really. I did have a large horn built by Alcoa for use at, I think, 910 megacycles, but it was never used
mm-hmm.
because I couldn't get anything. And the idea was to improve the aperture efficiency by cutting down the side lobes. You get a bigger opening at the orifice of the horn.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it was never used, and it got demolished at the Bureau of Standards, and that was the last I ever saw of it.
Yeah, I thought that in your early radio astronomy article that you mentioned that you used a horn at 480 megahertz.
No, if I did, I made a mistake.
Well, no, I'm probably remembering wrong. Let's see if I can find that. No, I don't see it. No, I must be remembering wrong. Okay.
It was a fairly large horn. It must have been about 6 feet long and about 2 feet or so in the aperture.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And the idea was to put a small drum at the back end of the horn. Because you see 2 feet on the aperture at 900 megacycles. 900 megacycles, that's about 30 centimeters. 2 feet,
that's two.
You give a couple of wavelengths across the aperture, which would improve the aperture efficiency.
Right, like you were just showing me here, yeah. Here's another article in Communications on electric resonance chambers, and this is what you used at both 910 and 160, right?
Yes, and the original observations at 162. You can tell by looking at the pictures, because the early pictures of the big drum show here. See? Small opening.
Right.
See?
Right.
And the antenna's back in here. Then when I got the broadband amplifier, I broadbanded out by taking this iris off mm-hmm. and putting cones in there instead of a wire. Well, that mm-hmm. drum and the cones all disappeared.
Let's see. Nothing else there. Now this was a review article in Radio News in 1948.
Yeah, this is the one where I had projections sticking out in the direction of Cassiopeia.
Right. I'm going to reproduce this figure. Because I think what you were trying to do here was to make the radiation from the galaxy into an antenna pattern that engineers could sort of understand.
Apparently so. Right. That was sure way off that one.
Well, it's a valid way to show the data. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of interesting.
You notice under good circumstances, there was a darn good signal-to-noise ratio.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt. Even here, I mean, there's no doubt that the lower envelope is that you've got a good signal there. Don't think there are any other questions here on that one. Okay, now this is beginning to get... No, we're still in Wheaton here. Okay. You wrote this letter to Nature in November 46, mm-hmm. and this was after you first picked up solar flares, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now, at this time, were you aware of the other solar observations by this time? Because you did write to Nature.
What do I say?
Well, you do. Well, you do give references to the two of them here.
Posse.
Posse.
Hey, obviously I was.
Right. Do you remember if that was only after you made the observations and then began to look through the literature, or?
I'm spaced.
And then here's another short little thing, the Proceedings of the IRE in 47.
Well, this was after I went to the ABS, but it was still all on the Wheaton data. This was all taken at Wheaton.
Right.
And this is just to show the difference, how the background fluctuates. See, over very large amounts from day to day.
Right.
Quite different than the few years previously when I was at 160 megacycles.
Why? I mean, where is Stirling, actually?
Well, roughly, it's about 20 miles or so airline from Washington, across the river, over into the back country of Virginia.
To the directly west, Mars?
Directly west.
Okay.
It's remarkable how quick you can get into the deep south when you get over into Virginia.
Yeah. Well, I used to live there. I went to the University of Maryland, so as a graduate student. Well, okay, I guess we're at the stage now to ask you, you've already more or less said why you wanted to leave Wheaton, and that the only opportunity you could find to continue this sort of research was at MBS.
That's right.
And you already commented on that your hope was to bring your antenna with you and continue the same sort of line, but they were sort of had other ideas. But can you just sort of summarize what you did do in the couple of years that you were at MBS?
When I got there, it was evident they weren't interested in radio astronomy. What they were interested in was justifying their own and my existence, which could be done in this roundabout way on ionospheric predictions.
Mm-hmm.
And so the program really consisted of doing solar radio observations, particularly looking for these transients and measuring them and their duration and that kind of stuff. And so, about that time, see, this is 1947, they'd lugged in a bunch of stuff from Europe, mainly German stuff, and this was done by the Signal Corps with the idea of assessing it for its military capability. And it was going to be turned into scrap. And so, we found out about this, and we got three of these Wurzburg dishes from Red Bank, Virginia, or Red Bank, New Jersey, and they were taken down, and I modified them somewhat and tipped them up so that instead of being azimuth mounted, they were polar mounted.
Mm-hmm.
And then we built some more electronic equipment and started making routine observations of solar radio waves at several frequencies, I think 53, 160, 480 megacycles, using bioelectronic gear, at least to begin with, although it was later changed. And this was done as a routine thing, and we collected vast amounts of this information. I don't know what it was ever used for, but we did it.
Well, the only publications, there was this one in Science in 51, in which you talked about the some of the bursts, motion in the solar atmosphere, you call it.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the only real publication I found on this. Were there internal NBS things, do you know?
Not much, really. They weren't really interested in this. It was just one of those things they did because they were doing it.
Yeah. But during this time, though, you did go up with Hagen and Haddock.
That's right.
To Alaska, so maybe if you could tell me about that business.
Well, Hagen's idea was to get some information about the radio corona of the sun using the moon to eclipse part of it. And this was a good idea and had more relevance at the microwave frequencies that NRL was observing at than at the frequencies we had available. However, they put some equipment at our disposal, and so Beck and I went up there and made some observations, and they're shown here. They don't tell you a great deal other than what you already knew, that is, the solar corona gets larger as the frequency gets lower, and the moon obscures less and less of it. And as you get down, I think 3 centimeters is the shortest wavelength they operate at, but the 3 centimeter, the corona is pretty much like the optical corona in size.
Is this Beck the same one as the NRL?
No, different Beck.
This is another Beck. Okay.
Bell Lab Beck is AC Beck. Right. This is Emmanuel A. Beck.
Okay.
Generation difference.
What about, how do you view that early NRL effort? I've talked to Mayer, and I haven't talked to either Hagen or Haddock yet, but...
How do I view it?
Yeah, I mean, were you sort of always working closely in contact with each other, or...?
Oh, more or less. We knew each other, and I went over and saw their stuff, and they came over and saw our stuff, but we weren't competing, we weren't even doing the similar things.
Because you were at such different frequencies, yeah. Basically.
I never did find out why they were doing it. That is, they seem to even have a more slender string to sustain them than we had.
Well, that's always been a problem. Yeah. It still is today, the NRL.
It seemed to be more an exercise in microwave technology than anything else.
Yeah, yeah.
And the frequencies they'd chosen made it pretty hopeless to do anything except soar or work with that equipment.
And so the idea of you getting involved was mainly for the 65-centimeter point, I guess.
Well, see, we had some low-frequency equipment, which they didn't have. And so by inviting us two to go along at 480 megacycles, it gave them 3, 10, what was it, 30 and...
3, 10 and 65 is plotted here.
It was 3 centimeters, 10 centimeters, and 65 centimeters. They only had 2, I guess. I thought, oh, they had some optical equipment they took along, but it was useless.
Here's the photocell here. Yeah. Seemed to... Mm-hmm.
So there were 3 radio frequencies that these wavelengths, 3, 10, 65 centimeters. And this is their optical equipment somewhere. Then it's showing.
Well, now here they say 4 radiometers. Oh, 8.5 millimeters they had also.
Maybe it didn't work.
Apparently. Or didn't work. I'm sure they say in here. The rain prevented use of this camera and the 8 millimeter receiver.
Oh, it just poured and blew.
Not a very beautiful eclipse. Huh? Well, let's see. There's a couple early reviews. That you did in Sky and Telescope and Scientific American. Don't think there's anything...
That Scientific American one, is that one there?
Yeah.
That's got my name on, but I didn't write it.
Oh, because they're...
It doesn't sound like me.
Yeah, their editor changed it so much, you mean? I've heard that other people say that about Scientific American, too.
Scientific American takes the bull by the horns and writes its own articles.
Here's a AAAS meeting in Boston, a symposium on radio astronomy.
Right, that was a Christmas time meeting.
Right, in which you gave an address.
I think this was just a sort of a synopsis thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was sort of showing the history of radio astronomy.
Yeah.
And
see, at that time, I think this was probably under Bach's administration. Anyhow, Bach, I think, was one of the promoters of this. And
may well have been.
The feeling was that radio astronomy hadn't been given a fair go. That is, the scientific community at large was mostly unaware of its even existence, and that we should get out and put our best foot forward and give some generalized things to educate these ignoramuses.
Right, right.
Show that there was something more to science than nuclear physics.
So this was a publicity effort, basically.
That's what it about.
Yeah.
This kind of thing occurred several times.
Is this true? Did you actually present this paper? It had it here that Krauss gave it in your absence.
What's it say here?
But then it's crossed out.
Paper to be presented because of Dr. Reber's absence in Boston, but I'm pretty sure I was there. I'm sure I was there.
Okay, well, someone has it crossed out. It wasn't me, so apparently that was to correct that. I forget where I got this thing. I've done a lot of scrounging.
I'll tell you a good story on this business of ignorance.
Yeah.
But I go on the Bureau of Standards, and that was 47. And it was either late 40, probably spring of 48. And the American Physical Society was holding an annual meeting there, quite a big thing, you know, several hundred people, maybe a couple thousand. And the promoters at NBS thought NBS ought to get somebody there to put NBS on the program.
Mm-hmm.
And what could they find? So they put the button on me and said, now you've got to go give them a paper. I said, all right, I'll tell about solar radio waves, because that's what we're doing here at NBS. And so they made all the necessary arrangements and got me on the program and so on and so on. I didn't have to do that. And the program was printed, and in due time, I went down there. I didn't attend all the sessions. I just went came. And I remember, this was a very large hall. I don't remember which hall it was, but there's two large structures. I think one of them is agriculture, I think on the west side of the White House. And, or was it there? Well, anyhow, it was a large hall.
And yeah, the Commerce Department, because NBS is part of the Commerce Department.
Commerce isn't agriculture there? Well, that doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
May not have been either one of those. I went to so many meetings, I've forgotten which one. But this was a very large hall. And it must have been about 11 o'clock in the morning. It's been, the sessions had been going for some time. And I got there a little before the previous paper had finished, you know, 5 minutes or so. And the previous paper was about some obtuse nuclear physics thing like nuclear cross-sections. And the hall was just jammed with people standing around the back, you know, and in the aisles. And a lot of people were smoking pipes, and there was a smoke-filled room. And finally, there was a couple of questions, but there wasn't much of any time. So the chairman closed the session, and then there was an intermission, you know, 5 minutes or so. And when this speaker quit, then practically everybody got up and went out. And they opened the doors and let some of the smoke out. And so then I was the first one on the next half of the program.
Right.
So I got up there, and Robbie was chairman. And pretty soon a few people filed back in, but the hall was more about a quarter filled.
Right.
So it was very evident that what the program said was uninteresting to the large majority of people. So Robbie got up there to introduce the speaker, and he reads the program, see? He says, our next speaker will be Mr. Grotweaver of the National Bureau of Standards, and his subject will be solar radio waves. And he looks at it. He looks at me. Then he looks at the program again. And he says, and the program, Mr. Weaver will tell us about solar radio waves. I hope that's all right. Then he says, stop. Well, it was pretty obvious that Robbie had never heard of solar radio waves,
right,
and he hadn't even read the program. So that was how far radio astronomy had infiltrated into the physics community.
That's a pretty good example already.
Well, anyhow, I gave him a spiel on solar radio waves instead of 15 minutes. And I guess it was all right, but it tickled me in a way.
Right.
You'd think that Robbie had at least read the program.
when he's the chairman of the session, yeah.
Yeah, and he doesn't have the faintest idea what solar radio waves were.
But then you've already told about Compton, who was an example of one who did have an open mind towards
this. Yeah, he's very different.
Right.
Very different.
But probably most physicists were more like Robbie.
Yeah, most of them were more like Robbie.
It just was something that they were not particularly interested in. Okay, well, we were talking about your tenure at NBS, and so you were measuring the sun, and
yeah.
I imagine you got tired of doing that after a while. And
well, the reason I left there was, it was one of these political things. We've had some examples of that in Australia just recently. But Colorado is, well, sort of a, not just poverty-stricken in the sense that Mississippi is, but doesn't have much to offer. That is, for instance, in all this log rolling, you got a bunch of guys from Illinois and Iowa. They're log rolling to get subsidies for their corn. And then there's the wheat boys out in Minnesota and the Dakotas. And there's the cotton boys down in the Gulf. And these guys have all got their axe to grind to keep their subsidies and their special privilege functioning.
Right.
So Colorado doesn't have anything like that. That is, they might have a little silver, but nobody much cares anything about that. So the special privilege boys are looking to pick up votes. They want somebody to get behind them and help push for wheat and corn and cotton. And so when Colorado comes around and says, now, what do you offer me? They haven't got much of anything to offer them, but they'll be glad to give them anything if Colorado will vote for wheat and corn and cotton.
So they got NDS.
So when some money, it looked like some money was going to become available to build some new laboratories for the Bureau of Standards, then the log rolling went in the direction of shoving this thing to Colorado, not because there was any point to send it out there, but simply because this was something Colorado could get. In other words, Senator Hollett and his boys could go around and say, now, we want that thing, because if you don't give us that thing, we won't vote for your corn, wheat, and cotton.
Mm-hmm.
And the corn, wheat, and cotton boys couldn't give a damn less. They decided that the whole thing was going to be shoved out there, which it was. And I got pretty tired of them at that point, because this equipment we had, I had worked on for several years and done my best to build it up and make it run. And it was old equipment. Some of that stuff, you know, was pretty old. It is, I looked at the production dates on those things. And the dogma has it that the British invented radar. Well, maybe. I'm not so damn sure on that. It is, there were 1938 dates on some of that Wurzburg equipment. So, in any case, what they wanted to do was have me pull everything down and lug it out to Colorado. I couldn't see that. That is, I wasn't dead set against going out there, but if they got that much money, let them buy some new stuff.
Yeah.
Scrap all the old stuff and let's go out there and start over and do something new, see? But to haul all that stuff down, lug it out there and set it all up again, it's like digging ditches to put the dirt in from other ditches.
Right.
And so I just quit it. What's the best?
So what was your next move then? So what was your next move?
Well, I got subsidy from this research corporation, and I wanted to try these sea interferometer experiments that Bolton had been doing in Australia.
And what year is this now?
1951.
And you've been supported by Research Corporation ever since, haven't you? You've been supported by Research Corporation.
Well, that's right.
Ever since.
And I had looked around a lot. And I was rather impressed with what Bolton had been doing out there, doing in Sydney. I thought this was a pretty good technique. And so I hung around to some place where you could see a source rising from the sea and setting into the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And this seemed like an opportunity. So I thought, all right, the future doesn't look very bright working for the Bureau of Standards. Why don't I give this a whirl for a few years and see how it goes? And so I went out there and worked in Hawaii for a while.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't very successful, but anyhow, it was different.
What did you actually do in Hawaii?
Well, I found this volcano called Haleakala, the native Hawaiian being the home of the sun, or the place dedicated to the sun.
Right.
And there was an access road to the top, and that's one reason for choosing it. The other main reason for choosing it was from the top of that you could see a sea horizon off to the east and around to the north. But you could see from the island of Hawaii, it was to the southeast. And then you could see all the way around